Hello, I'm Kate Chabot. This time on SITREP, will Britain be ready to fight a war in 3 years' time? We pose the question as the head of the army warns of an increasingly volatile world. General Sir Rowley Walker says we have just enough time to get ready to deter conflict or fight a war, but change is urgently needed.
I have a bold ambition to double the fighting power in 3 years and triple it by the end of the decade.
But what does the army have to do to modernise quickly to meet the new challenges on the battlefield, as shown by the conflict in Ukraine? And is it achievable in a short time frame? And is the idea of a big army mindset where numbers determine fighting power out of date? Or is mass still needed, and how should troops fight? We'll discuss these critical questions for the army with Professor Mike Clark and our guests this week. And the moment that made Andrew Fox, after 8 years in the army, passing P Company to earn his maroon beret and become a para.
You feel a foot taller, you feel a foot wider, and you feel that you've really achieved something. And it's just a very special moment that I don't think any airborne soldier ever forgets.
SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
So, Micah, remind us the background of the new CGS and how it might inform his thinking about the future.
Yes, I mean, everyone says about him now that he's at Special Forces. More importantly, he had combat command experience at every level, really, company level, squadron commander, battle group level, brigade level, and then commander of all the Special Forces. I mean, everyone concentrates on the Special Force issue. And in a way, it shouldn't be relevant. It's a bit of a mixed bag because some people say, oh, well, as a Special Forces commander, he's very flexible. He'll understand the benefits of improvisation, just getting the job done, can-do attitude. And others say, well, you know, Special Forces people, they all believe in a sort of military conjuring trick. And when you're dealing with the whole army, which is a big organization, you can't really do that. I mean, the issue is not whether he was or wasn't Special Forces. The issue is whether he's a change manager for a big organization that's got to change very quickly. So he knows that. That's what he's got to be judged on. And he's a very bright guy and he's very self-aware. So we'll see how it works out for him.
Well, Sean Grescheck Melbourne is here. Hi, Sean. Sean was at the RUSI Land Warfare Conference in London, where General Sir Rowley Walker gave his first public speech since becoming CGS. And we're delighted also to be joined by Ed Arnold, Senior Fellow at RUSI and a former Army officer. Welcome, Ed. Welcome to everybody. Sean, a big moment for the new CGS, wasn't it? What could the Army look like in a few years' time?
Okay, as we heard him say in that clip earlier, he wants to double the army's fighting power in 3 years, triple it by the end of the decade. And he said the need is urgent. He was telling journalists that a range of threats could converge in approximately 3 years' time. And we heard the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, he was asked about this three-year timescale to get ready. And he says he completely agrees with CGS. Now, in his speech, he stressed that we're not on an inevitable path to war, but he warned of the need to restore credible hard power. The general says he thinks that however the war in Ukraine ends, that Russia will still be very, very dangerous and will want some form of retribution. Now, he didn't directly appeal for further funding or troops in his speech, but he touched on widespread concerns about the size of the army, leaving no doubt where he stands on the issue.
I do think we have struggled to shake a big army mindset where some still believe that raw troop numbers determines our fighting power. And I think that is out of date. We are, in fact, a medium-sized army, and we should embrace that as the catalyst that drives even greater integration for a more powerful joint force.
Mike, he talks there about that joint force, more powerful joint force, meaning NATO. What is your assessment of the time frame he's talking about to prepare 3 years?
Yes, I mean, it's based on the assessment that European security is getting darker, it's getting much more contested, and that in 3 years' time, whatever happens in Ukraine, whether the Russians are successful in Ukraine or not successful in Ukraine, we will face a Russia that is more troublesome to the rest of us, that is aggressive. If it fails in Ukraine, it will be aggressive elsewhere. If it succeeds in Ukraine, then it will try to follow up on that success in ways that will be a real problem for the rest of Europe. And the general assessment is, and Rowley Walker's reflecting what a lot of people are saying now, is that by about 2027, there will be a strategic moment for Europe. That's what they say, a strategic moment. We don't know what form it will take, but in 3 years' time, things will be so different, whatever happens in Ukraine, that we're going to have to respond to it, and NATO will have to respond. And we haven't got 10 years, as we used to assume. We've got perhaps 3 years, maybe four or five, if we're lucky. But we should assume 3 years to be, as it were, prudent. And that's not a lot of time to make the sort of changes that the army will need to make by then, if it's even minimally ready for a fighting war somewhere in Europe.
Yeah, it's very sobering, isn't it? And Ed, interesting what he says about a big army mindset. The troop numbers alone don't determine fighting power.
Yeah, and I think he's right in terms of, you know, challenging that assumption. We always talk about mass, and that is important. But actually, I mean, there's a bit of continuity in what he says in terms of the previous Defence Command paper last year, where it's actually saying, well, the mass is provided by NATO forces, which number 3.1 million, which is obviously very, very significant. And I think there's a lot of context here to set it in, you know, the UK is one of 32 allies. And actually, when you're talking about it as the army as a service, the British Army is one of 100 services pretty much across NATO. So this is very much more about what the UK can do and also the UK contribution. We obviously contribute significantly through air and maritime assets and critically the nuclear deterrent as well. So I think what the general's trying to say is put it in that wider context and then sort of explain about what his views of the military is. And yes, troop numbers are low. I think what the critical issue about that is also the army is used effectively as a fourth emergency service within the UK, increasingly, you know, COVID vaccines, backfilling, you know, ambulance drivers, and also, you know, fire service, for example. And speaking as an ex-military officer, that's very, very difficult. So there's actually other options that you can do within the wider UK national security machinery to actually make sure that the what army that you do have is fully focused on war fighting.
And Sean, what did the CGS say about how he wants to achieve this doubling of the army's fighting power?
Well, he says he wants to speed up aspects of the army's modernisation to field formations that are much more powerful and earlier than the programme plans. While there are numerous challenges, which he doesn't wish away, he says, this is not science fiction. That was the specific way that he decided to describe it. It's not science fiction. He spoke about Ukraine's achievements from land using a hybrid system. He wants to follow suit and make the most of artificial intelligence, other forms of new technology, and harness those.
The big, bold bet, and this should be of no surprise after the last few days, is on the exploitation of rapidly maturing technologies fueled by artificial intelligence, which leverages the booming technology sector as the catalyst to our modernization. We want an any network, one that is capable of connecting any sensor from any domain, from any partner to any effector. And this will create that internet of military things capable of quickly, cleanly, and efficiently integrating sensors and effectors for impact.
Mike, when he talks about this any network, can you just explain a bit more about what it is exactly?
Yes, I mean, in a way, the clue is the Internet of Things. I mean, we're used to the idea of the Internet of Things in our own daily lives, where everything can be connected to everything else, in theory, and so that should apply in the military as well. I mean, what he's always said is that Patrick Sanders, the previous CGS, put all the hardware in place. So we now know what the hardware is for the Army, which is based on Challenger 3, Ajax, Boxer, and then new artillery systems as and when they come in, MLRS and so on. So we know what the hardware is going to look like, and that really can't be changed. So now we've got to concentrate on the software, how to network this properly and to make it more effective and use it as the basis for successive incremental changes. So the any system is using this civilian basis of the Internet of Things, applying it to the military. There are threats when you do that, of course, because if everything is connected to everything else, it is potentially more vulnerable. So you've got to make sure that it's very, very secure. But the promise of an any system is that you can use your hardware to the most effective degree by connecting everything to everything else.
Ed, you were an infantry officer, weren't you, in the British Army? What's your take on his ambitions and how that might change the role of the infantry over the next few years?
I think Mike's just laid out quite well, and Sean earlier just sort of more on the physical component. So what the general said was talking about fighting power. Also, you know, there's the conceptual component, sort of doctrine, and the moral component. He used some examples of Ukraine about the conceptual component, of basically how they've fundamentally transformed very, very quickly, and he wants to emulate that. My concern there would be that Ukraine are doing it within the context of an existential war. So your ability to effectively make, you know, operations and tactical and doctrinal development loops very, very quickly. I mean, they said that the innovation cycle through a range of activities in Ukraine now is around 8 to 12 weeks potentially. So actually you see 15 cycles since the Russian invasion of 2022. That's pretty significant, and that's wartime innovation. It's very, very difficult to replicate that in peacetime, and it'll be very, very difficult for the British Army to do that and modernise to that extent. But I think there's a lot of lessons learned. And then finally, on the moral component, sort of the, you know, leadership, ethical foundations, etc. I mean, you know, the British Army has traditionally been very, very strong in that area. But again, Ukraine are developing that moral components. It's really been the difference between Ukraine and Russia since the invasion, and is actually one of those aspects which was probably the key determinant of Ukraine surviving that initial Russian onslaught. It's again, it'll be very interesting how the general thinks that they can improve the moral component to that sufficient level within that time while in peacetime. These are going to be the critical challenges. You can't just emulate Ukraine, because the context is they are doing this for real and they're doing it day in, day out. We are not yet, although there are mechanisms to learn from them.
And Ed, just to add to that, though, how in practice do you think it might be on the battlefield? How different might it be for the soldiers of the future?
Very, very different. But this is, I think, the compacted sort of transformation timescales. I mean, what the British Army used to do, or the wider UK defence, is design your force for 10 years. So in 2015, you design it for 2025, and you had a long lead time to develop. I think what people are saying is that's now much, much shorter. And your software development, your hardware development has to be compacted as well. Otherwise, things will be out of date very, very quickly. The new NATO Joint Training and Education Centre, which is a joint Ukrainian-NATO aspect, is going to be absolutely critical to understand, you know, how the Russians are fighting, how the Ukrainians are fighting, and what that might mean for NATO in the future. But the critical determinant of this is the military that survives this war, if it does, from the Russian side, will be very, very different to the one that goes in. So it's going to be very difficult, again, to sort of stay ahead of that curve. And I think some of this software elements that they were talking about is also on the training side. So it's not just in terms of battlefield management systems, etc. It's making sure that you can train at higher echelons and far more realistic training to prepare for a potential future war.
Sean, obviously industry plays a key role in bringing about the changes more quickly. What did the general have to say about that?
Well, he made the point that capital is flowing into the defence sector. He said, obviously, there is self-interest at play. That's how our system works. But investors also recognise that a lot is at stake. We share mutual values as well as mutual interests, he told the conference. And as a chief, he says he recognises his responsibility to help them understand our national security challenges so they can sharpen investment in the most promising solutions that double our fighting power. And earlier on in the conference, it was really interesting. There was an analogy that was brought forward about how Formula One, you know, who they partner with now. You know, in the 80s, their sponsors would be tobacco companies. But now, you know, you've got companies like Hewlett-Packard. And at the start of a race, they're sending back all of that data to those guys, and they're analyzing, you know, through AI, you know, how do they win that race, and sending that data back. I think that's what we're talking about here, you know, partnering with industry and making sure that we make the most of AI, you know, so it's going directly back to the battlefield as quickly as it can.
Mike, CGS talks about a hybrid system as the army transitions from old fighting systems and kit to new. He says that that can inspire creativity and vigour, can make the hybrid system devastatingly lethal now. What kind of creativity is he talking about exactly? What kind of examples could you give?
Yeah, I mean, he's talking about the ability to buy on the world market stuff that is available now and then transform it with our better software. And particularly, you think about ground-based air defence. I mean, the Army is very short of air defence assets. And so he's talking about a bottom-up model. Instead of thinking about what do we need in 2035, 2040, and then trying to design for it now and then work backwards, which takes a long time, buy the stuff that's out there now and transform it with software innovation. And ultimately, we have to back ourselves to be good at that. And I think we can if we, this is what he's saying, you know, we are better at innovation than most of our peer competitors. And certainly we're better at it than the Russians, although the Russians have been doing it now in war for a couple of years. But if we start doing this, we will do it better if we just commit ourselves to it. So ground-based air defense, deep fires, more innovation in cruise missile technologies. We can do quite a lot with that. And we can probably do quite a lot even with the fixed assets or the heavy metal that we know we're going to inherit in the armored forces and the Ajax and Boxer. We can do more to adjust the way they work and actually to work with them on using radio, new radio waves to confuse drones. That's a big issue. Anti-drone technologies, laser technologies, which are now look as if they're on the verge of some real maturity. There's a lot we can do there, which is within our grasp now, is what he's saying. If we just put our minds to working incrementally instead of starting at the top down and working backwards, which is what we always do in peacetime.
And Ed, on that ambition for the army to double and triple its fighting power, and the general saying any British land force will be able to destroy a force at least three times its size and keep on doing that, what about the arguments on the battlefield that mass still has a large role to play to occupy and hold ground, for example?
Yeah, and this is really where some of the difficulty comes in. I mean, I think what the general is really talking about is that what we refer to these days as the first battle, and within a NATO context, that would probably be just prior to Article 5 or when Article 5 might be enacted and effectively NATO goes to war with Russia. And that's predominantly going to be seen in Eastern Europe. It's also going to be seen on the flanks in Southern Europe, particularly up in the Arctic and high north. And that is effectively a first battle, which, considering the scale and also the lethality of some of these systems, that's going to be pretty big war. The issue is, there's always the desire or need for second echelon forces to fight that second and third battle strategic reserve. And that is ultimately where you will need the mass. Like I say, I mean, there's a little bit of a trade-off here, but I think the arguments which is being made from the UK point of view is, I mean, you know, that mass doesn't necessarily have to come from the UK. I think it's an argument that the UK can also make with NATO by playing on other strengths in terms of the air, maritime domain, and also, of course, the nuclear deterrent. But I think it's less about the military aspect of this, it's about the political aspect of it. And we commit very large land forces in terms of a division that's now appears to be to a UK sovereign core level to NATO. So in effect, we are sort of simultaneously saying, well, we're not going to do mass, but we are going to commit mass to NATO. So I think that sort of discussion really needs to be made within that context. And also towards the end of the year with the US elections, because the way that NATO works is they assume that they have, you know, US combat capabilities and also enablers. So actually, if the US starts to maneuver assets out of Europe, which they're almost certainly going to do regardless of who wins, then actually the demands on the UK could significantly increase. And there's an idea whereby, yes, we might do lots of other things. We might have lots of technological superiority. We might have long-range fires. But you also do need soldiers alongside allies in foxholes, because that's politically what allies buy into, because they know that if UK forces are attacked, then the UK forces are going to support. So there's a huge political element to this as well, which will need sort of, you know, ongoing discussions with allies within NATO.
So, ambitious words from the CGS, and as you point out, demands on UK forces could increase. Sean, no discussion, though, on funding in that speech. And, of course, all of this is against the backdrop of a defence review where everything might change in a year's time.
Exactly, Kate. And whatever the government decides off the back of the review, we could all of a sudden see a different direction politically, new ideas. We will hopefully know by then precisely when they're willing to raise defence spending to 2.5%. And as Ed said, you know, there's a lot going on over the next 12 months. Predominantly, all eyes will be on America in November. And just how will the family of 32 work if it is a Trump-Vance White House? And if America does decide to impose any level of reprioritization away from UCOM. So there are some big questions. A lot can happen over the next 12 months. And I don't envy any of the politicians looking at this or anyone taking part in the defense review and in trying to figure it out, because the whole theme running through the last few days at the conference, you know, is doing everything at pace and at speed. If in a year's time we change gear again, that's going to create an even trickier situation.
Mike, just to pick up on something that Ed was talking about in terms of our commitments to NATO, interoperability presumably is going to be more important than ever if we're asking troops from foreign country to be involved and back up on the second wave. I mean, can you envisage that the way training exercises are done is going to have to change as well to make them more potent and more immediate?
Yes, I mean, we've all got to train together more. The problem is that, you know, exercising together is very expensive. Everyone says how valuable it is, but my goodness, it's expensive. And it takes a long time to set up, years sometimes, to set up these big, like, Steadfast Defender operations, which years in the planning, the big exercise that's gone on this year. So we will need to do more of that, and we've got to commit to it. And, I mean, you know, what Ed was saying is that, you know, Britain wants to be a strategic reserve for NATO. There are certain things in which we can be in the front line, as in our air power, but in our land power and our naval power, we are the strategic reserve. So we make a difference. And as Rowley Walker said, we make the difference not on day one, which is what we used to assume with the British Army of the Rhine. We're on day 90. We are D plus 90 in the sense that we actually make a difference, or we hope we do, after about 3 months, when we can bring pressure to bear and we can bring some real combat power to bear. But we've got to do that through real interoperability with our allies. They've got to believe in us, which, to be honest, they haven't done recently because our forces have been so thin. They've got to believe in us. They know that we've got the moral courage to do these things, but have we the real capability on the ground to do it? And we've got to build up that credibility with our allies and also to encourage them to pull their weight as well. We're very good with words in Britain about transatlantic commitments. We haven't been so good with the reality in recent years. We've got to get that back.
So if the UK has been at pains to stress that it's pursuing a NATO first policy, how are we measuring up on our commitments?
We meet our baseline commitments in terms of the forward land forces in Estonia and equally a lot of, you know, Baltic air policing, wider air policing, and also maritime domains. But I think there is a critical issue to sort of be raised within the land component, because, you know, at the Russian Land Warfare Conference, it was recommitted that we are going to offer a core to NATO, and that would be UK sovereign, was the implication of the not confirmed and no date. But we'd already committed to a division by 2025, which slipped till 2030, and that seems to still be a stretch target. So we're talking cores and divisions in terms of what we provide to NATO, but then when you actually look at the forward land forces, you know, it's still a battle group. We haven't matched Germany in terms of pushing to go to a brigade, though we've exercised at that level. So it just does really seem to be a discrepancy on that NATO first model about what echelon we can actually provide, and critically for our allies, when.
Well, really look forward to continuing this conversation another time and picking up on developments. Ed Arnold, Sian Grzeszczyk, Melbourne, thank you so much.
This is SITREP.
Now, this week's moment that made me comes from someone who, after 8 years in the army, was thinking of getting out. Andrew Fox had served several tours of duty in Afghanistan and seen plenty of action, yet he still couldn't find his place. He decided to try one last route via one of the army's most grueling selection tests.
I was someone looking for a career in the army at this point. I'd done everything that I wanted to do on operations, but I didn't feel I had a regimental home particularly. I didn't enjoy my time served in my first regiment. I'd been away on two tours of Afghanistan with other regiments and other units. and I'd fit in and felt a lot happier serving with them than I did in the regiment I commissioned into. So I was really out of options at this point. I tried Air Corps selection and failed on the eyesights. I'd tried Special Forces selection and I broke my ankle on the hills. So really, I served on Harrogate with 16 Air Assault Brigade, and I was pretty sure that airborne forces was something I wanted to be part of.
So what was the moment that made you?
So it was passing P Company. I'd had a chance to go on it a couple of years earlier, but my ankle wasn't up to it. I was still recovering from breaking it. So to finally get around P Company was a huge moment of achievement. It shows you what you're made of physically. It shows you what you're made of mentally. And as an experience, it was just a great period of teamwork and a bunch of really motivated people working really hard towards the same goal, which was a great taster of life in airborne forces, because that's what it's like when you join a unit there.
Can you tell me what was involved in that moment then in passing P Company? Tell me what you had to do. And you said that previously you tried and it had not worked out. What was it like?
So screening day is the first day where you have to do an 8 miler tab and a mile and a half run back to back, and then do the Trainasium assault course. And so first time I hadn't been able to get around that because my ankle was not playing the game. So coming, you know, relatively high on my screening day went for real was a really big morale boost. I felt confident that I could do it. And then you've really got 2.5 weeks of beat up, which is getting thrashed up and down the hills in Catterick twice a day, every day. It was culminating in test week, which is a series of traditional test events, which, you know, every airborne soldier has to do, including its log runs, stretcher runs, a 10 miler, a 20 miler, and so on and so forth. And at the end of it, you have a beret parade where you line up in your ranks and by number, they tell you if you've passed or failed. And I was number one. So it was number one pass and I got awarded my Marine beret. And it really felt like the start of a journey, and it led to a fantastic kind of 10 years in airborne forces.
And what was it about the paras that made you think it might be your place in the army?
First of all, just the incredible professionalism of the soldiers. That they were the next level to anyone I'd ever served with before in terms of what they could achieve, both physically and in terms of just endurance and mentality. Also, as an officer, I really enjoyed the interaction with the soldiers. They were so confident. You know, they would always push you on your ideas and push you on your orders that you gave. And it made you a better officer in turn, because you knew that the stuff that you were doing was getting put under the highest possible scrutiny. And then there's the role of the paras, where it's so diverse in terms of what you might be asked to do. You know, it could be one day you'd be out in Kenya training to do a non-combatant evacuation operation. The next day you could be jumping into France alongside the French as part of the combined joint expeditionary force. So it's just that incredible diversity of task and just the brilliance of parachute regiment soldiers who were just a joy to work with and command.
And clearly you wanted to challenge yourself. How tough was P Company?
I mean, it's a brutal course, and it's a 60% or lower pass rate for a very good reason. And mine was particularly unpleasant because I went down with a stomach bug in week two, and it was only the snow that really saved me. So we had an afternoon on the assault course cancelled. So I went to bed and just shook like a leaf for 12 hours. Well, and here's where the teamwork comes into it. Everyone went out and bought me drugs from Tesco. They brought me food and water to my bed to help me try and get through it. And then the next day we had a really long navigation exercise where I could just get my Bergen on my back and just grizz it out.
So I'm right in thinking that you did your 3 tours of Afghanistan before this?
Yeah, so I did one with the Mercians, one with the Royal Welsh attached to 16 Air Assault Brigade, and then one with the US Army Special Forces.
But those experiences in themselves, why did they not be the experiences that you chose as formative ones? Because when you talk about your time on your third tour, it sounded highly kinetic and very adrenaline packed.
It was, but I simply felt that I was doing my job. Didn't feel particularly pushed outside my comfort zone in some ways. You know, in the British Army, you're phenomenally well trained and prepared for these things.
So when you got the beret, when you passed, can you tell me how that changed your life and your career?
Yeah, so you know, there's the feeling of elation that comes from having achieved something really worthwhile. When you put that Marine beret on for the first time, you do feel instantly a foot taller. The way my career then took a direction, I just got given a succession of just incredible jobs that kept me engaged, kept me challenged, kept me motivated, and were incredibly rewarding. And I don't think without P Company, any of those things would have happened. You know, I got to serve at the SFSG in St. Athan. I got to do trips abroad and had experiences, you know, skydiving out of Black Hawk helicopters over the Middle East, driving around sand dunes and thrashing ourselves in vehicles. You know, it was just incredible. And then, you know, I had Lance Corporal Josh Leakey in my company. So I had the honor of taking him through his Victoria Cross award process. And that was a real honor as well. And then going over to 3 Power and the stuff we did there, tours of Bosnia, trips abroad to Spain, United States, it just opened the doorway to me to have just the most amazing final 10 years of my career.
SFSG?
Special Forces Support Group.
When you look back now on that time, the moment that made you, how do you think it changed you as a person?
I think it gave me more confidence. I think it showed me that I had levels that I'd not reached yet. You know, it was a brilliant induction into the ethos of Airborne Forces. The original motto for Airborne Forces generally was ad unum omnes, all for one cause. And the experience you go through on P Company really symbolises that motto.
You've been very open about the post-traumatic stress disorder that you have actually suffered as a result of your service. Is there anything about the P Company experience that has helped you manage that?
I mean, potentially there's a mental resilience that comes with getting through that experience of PTSD, you know, having the ability to just keep going when it's really, really challenging. I think potentially that resilience sort of helped out. And also my regiment were fantastic. They were absolutely a family when it came to this. And I was really well looked after by the Parachute Regiment and by the Airborne Forces charity in terms of support. So, you know, it gave me that sort of family wraparound as well as the mental resilience to keep going.
You seem to be someone who's often challenged themselves in many areas, and you've got degrees in law, politics, modern war studies, psychology. How did they compare to the kind of things you learned in P Company?
I think it comes with a high level of drive. I think that's what P Company needs. You can't pass P Company if you don't have that drive inside you. So when there's that little voice in your head that says, stop, you turn around to it and you say, no, I'm not, I'm keeping going. And I think, you know, I've got plenty of friends and former soldiers who've gone on to great things after the army because they have that drive and that motivation. And I think for me, that's manifested itself in going out to academia and getting degrees and then using those degrees to have another career. So, you know, it's about that that motivation that comes from a place that maybe you don't know before you've done P Company.
And if I could ask you to cast your mind back to standing on that parade ground and being told you had been passed, what did it feel like? Were you aware it was a new beginning for you?
It was just almost like an adrenaline dump. You know, you're so nervous before the beret parade, you don't know if you're passed or not. And you get that number one pass in my case, and all of a sudden you feel a foot taller, you feel a foot wider, and you feel that you've really achieved something. And it's just a very special moment that I don't think any airborne soldier ever forgets.
And is there anything that you can pass on to us that we can learn from the moment that made you?
I think it's just the power of mentally keeping going. I think people are a lot stronger sometimes than they actually realise. You know, you could be like me and lucky that you have a very set course to follow on P Company that shows you what you're capable of. But I think that the lesson for anyone listening is that you're capable of a lot more than you realise. And sometimes it's only when you're really tested that you make that discovery. But we've all got it in us.
Andrew Fox, it's been great talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks very much.
Mike, that sense of achievement that he was communicating there, really infectious. And I took from talking to him that he really felt he belonged in the Paras. Highlights the importance of finding what feels right, your right place in the forces.
Yes. I mean, Dr. Johnson famously said, I mean, every man thinks more meanly of himself for not having gone for a soldier. And if you go into the army, there is a niche for you somewhere because it's such a big organization doing different sorts of things. And, you know, everybody, some people join for the uniform, some people join for the lifestyle, some people join for the camaraderie. Everybody joins to a degree for the personal challenge. They want to challenge themselves personally. And in Andrew's case, he went for the biggest sort of challenge, which is to go for the Paras, the airborne. And, you know, the airborne are the light soldiers. They're lightly armed soldiers for a specific job. And famously, you know, when the 101st, the Screaming Eagles, the American 101st Airborne, from where the Band of Brothers came from, that was their unit. When they were going into Bastogne in 1944 during the Battle of the Bulge, and as they were going into Bastogne, those American troops who were being withdrawn were shouting at them, "You've got to be surrounded, guys, you've got to be surrounded." And they looked at them and they said, "We're the 101st, we're always surrounded." That's the airborne.
Great stuff. Mike, thank you so much. And thanks to all of our guests. That is all for now. Professor Michael Clark and I will be back with another SITREP next Thursday. Until then, you can always catch up with past programmes you might have missed online at bfbs.com/SITREP, the Forces News YouTube channel, or wherever you get your podcasts. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for listening. Bye-bye.